Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Saturday, vigils were held for Sebastian Francisco Perez, a 38-year-old farm worker who tragically died on June 26th, the first day of the heat wave in St. Paul, Oregon, where temperatures topped 104 degrees. Some workers had no choice but to work overnight or early in the morning to try to avoid the heat. But it was almost impossible. Members of the United Farm Workers Union said they've been frustrated by the emphasis on companies protecting cherries and blueberries instead of the predominantly Latino workers. The AP reports that the United Farm Workers is calling on Washington Governor Jay Inslee to immediately issue emergency heat standards protecting all farm workers and others who work outside. The state's current heat standards fall short of safeguards. The UFW first one in California in 2005 that have prevented deaths and illnesses from heat stroke. Farm workers die of heat-related causes at a rate of 20 times that of all other professions, according to a new report called Essentially Unprotected from the Vermont Law School Center for Agriculture and Food Systems. A majority of migrant and undocumented workers are especially vulnerable to extreme heat, not only because of their direct exposure, but also because of a lack of other social and labor protections. And this is something that we have covered on a regular basis. What will it take to protect farm workers, especially from deadly heat? Today, we're joined by Elizabeth Strader, Director of Strategic Campaigns at United Farm Workers, the nation's largest farm workers union. Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
We're also joined by Chelsea DeMoss. Chelsea is from a farm worker family and worked in the fields in eastern Washington as a child and teen. She still has family working in the fields. Chelsea has been doing volunteer outreach in the Yakima Valley during the recent extreme heat wave. Hi, Chelsea. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I want to start off by remembering Sebastian Francisco Perez, because I think it's so important to just, and it's kind of ridiculous to have to say this, but all of these farm workers have stories. They have loved ones. Many of them have children. And I feel like sometimes in some stories, his name isn't even included in the piece. So someone set up a GoFundMe for Sebastian Francisco Perez. And according to this GoFundMe, he was a husband, a brother, and a son from Guatemala, and they set up this GoFundMe to support his family in Guatemala and help with any expenses they have. Elizabeth, what can you tell us about Sebastian?
Well, I think you're right on the ticket there. He was a beloved and essential member of his community. He came here not out of out of interest, but out of economic desperation. He was, you know, a husband and desperately wanted to be a father. He was here trying to get the money together for some medical treatments for his wife. And this is the kind of death that is, his name might be an afterword, just a small detail in the coverage around the rulemaking and the government procedures and the policies, but you know, it leaves a huge hole in a community when you lose someone like this. And in our, in our lines of work, both Chelsea's and mine, when you hear of these deaths or these injuries or these illnesses or these poisonings or any of these harms that befall farm workers, I don't know how you feel, Chelsea, but it's very common for us to call our parents and check in and think about there, but for the grace of God, go I, because it really is just such incredibly dangerous work. And I think there's something really ironic about the fact, it's not ironic, it's just dark, but, you know, when he died, Sebastian was caring for and irrigating seedling shade trees, and he didn't have shade himself.
Mm. Wow. Chelsea, what would you add? Journalist Sergio Olmos had a piece in the New York Times about Sebastian, and he reports that Sebastian was stressed about the debt he owed smugglers who helped him cross to the United States from Guatemala. He told a relative that he needed money. He was making less than $12 an hour to work with that Saturday crew. He collapsed in the fields, and then he died that day.
Unfortunately, this is not an uncommon situation for most farm workers. I know that, you know, personally from just my experience, my family had to worry about their debts too. And the reason why I ended up in the fields was also because they lacked the resources like, you know, childcare. And so they had us there and they were just out there working as hard as they could while being stressed out and trying to balance us being there, balance out, you know, bills and things like that. So it doesn't shock me that this happened. You know, there's a lack of basic resources there on the fields for workers. And, you know, then on top of that, there's their personal stress, their, you know, their personal, their lives, their livelihoods that they have to worry about. And it's just unfortunate. And it's just, it just has me thinking and many thinking, how many more farm workers need to die for this to be a priority, you know? And it's just a tragedy.
And we should say that this GoFundMe was started by PCUN, Oregon's Farm Worker Union. They had a $10,000 goal, and so far they've raised just over $21,000. And we've got a link if you'd like to read more about Sebastian Francisco Perez. You know, when you think about a state like Washington and the fact that it lacks so many basic protections in the year 2021, what explains this, Elizabeth? Why is a state like Washington so far behind a state like California? I mean, it's definitely not perfect in California, but farm workers who say that if they do work on a union farm, at least they do have basic protections and they feel like they can call someone to say, I need more water or I need more shade. But that's not the case in Washington state. Why is that?
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple of things. I'll say that Washington state, you know, again, no one is saying that we're, you know, we're certainly, you know, petitioning for urgent action right now. So there are shortcomings, but there are a lot of states. I work for a national organization and there are a lot of states that, if I wanted to pick up the phone and just urgently get on with, you know, somebody like Labor and Industries in Washington, you know, or with somebody, you know, at the state, OSHA level, I would have no ability to call someone and have someone be substantively responsive to me. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate how responsive L&I is to our organization and to our membership. They really are. And so, you know, they have, the state of Washington has, you know, arrived at overtime, has, you know, there's going to be overtime equity for farm workers, which is, you know, where they have access to overtime protections, same as, you know, almost every other worker has. The fundamental reason that farm workers are lacking so many of these rights is because back in the 30s, when the basic federal labor laws of our country were written, the Fair Labor Standards Act and the National Labor Relations Act, farm workers were excluded from those protections because there was no way to pass it. The Southern congressmen were not going to provide these labor rights for workers that they associate with, essentially with slavery. So that racist exclusion of farm workers from, and there's a few other categories, specifically domestic workers and farm workers. So truly, this is work that had been historically, you know, been associated with slavery in the South. So those exclusions persist. And so when you talk about the exclusions from really basic things like child labor laws, minimum wage, overtime exclusion, you know, overtime protections. And overtime is, you know, that was a bitter battle in California. It was a bitter battle in Oregon. It was, that continues. It's a bitter battle. It was a bitter battle in Washington that required both legislative and judicial intervention. And, you know, the reason that overtime is essentially health and safety protection as well. It's the same, you know, along with the heat standards. These are rules that are really minimal rules that keep any industry from feeling entitled to pushing the human body what it's meant to endure. The human body is not meant to work 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. You know, the human body is not meant to work without rest, without shade, without break in 110 degree weather. So, you know, when you talk about these exclusions from some of these, you know, really, really basic protections, that goes back to the 30s in this country. And there's gotta be a tipping point on this, a moral referendum on whether or not these people are worth as much as everyone else. And, you know, that's really what we're saying. So when, you know, you're looking at a state like Washington, where there are actually some quite progressive things. I mean, they're going to reach overtime equity for farm workers before California does. So there's, you know, it's back and forth. There's some really basic things lacking. But then, you know, there's other things that are super progressive as well. But outside of California, farm workers do not even have the right to form a union. You know, they do not have access to the NLRB. You know, it isn't as simple as a card check. And so outside of California, the vast majority, and in fact, in California as well, the vast majority of farm workers in the United States are not protected by a union. And I can't tell you how much of a difference it is. You can have the same worker, and I've seen this, you have the same worker who has, you know, who moves between two different employers with the seasons, and they are so empowered on that union farm.
Wow.
And they are absolutely not empowered, even when they know that the rule that, you know, I have this right or I have this rule should be protecting me, but it isn't. When they are on a union farm, they're so much more likely to speak up for their rights as opposed to, you know, when they know how vulnerable they are at a non-union workplace.
Chelsea, there was a really good piece in Civil Eats about this, and they pointed out that unions in California, we're talking about farms in California, they have texting programs, they've got Facebook groups for farm workers, and will make in-person appearances at farms to educate workers on their rights. If a farm worker is experiencing an issue, UFW will walk them through their options and their rights and escalate the complaint to Cal OSHA if necessary. So what will it take to get these basic rights in other states like Washington?
I think in some ways Chelsea is a future answer to that question, just thinking about the representation in our civic structures.
Chelsea?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Unfortunately, it's coming down to community members like you and me just going out and doing something about it. I saw the flyer for UFW looking for volunteers, and I went out there, and I did not think that it would, you know, essentially kind of go viral and people were starting to pay more attention. And I'm just happy that I'm able to use my platform to just continue to spread that awareness and inspire other people to ultimately take action. I mean, I'm currently running for office for this reason. You know, my platform is to fight for farm workers and immigrant rights. And I'm just hoping that other people will join the fight too. And, you know, our lawmakers can hopefully, you know, pay attention and do something about it. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to ensure that my people have representation at the table too. I want a seat at the table. We want a seat at the table, and we want to make sure that our voices are being heard.
You're a candidate for a city council seat in Sunnyside, Washington. Is that right?
Yes, I am. District 4.
And you actually helped pass out cold water after seeing a flyer asking for volunteers.
Yes, that's correct. I saw this and I was immediately moved, and I just, you know, told my partner and friends, we just need to go out there. We have time. Like, let's just, you know, go volunteer a few of our hours before work and let's just do this. And so I continued volunteering after that as well.
And by 8 a.m. on the Tuesday during the heat wave, it was already 87 degrees.
Yes, it was extremely hot. I immediately started feeling symptoms of heat exhaustion when I was out there. I was feeling lightheaded. I felt like I couldn't think straight. So I had to take a couple breaks myself. And I wasn't even out there, you know, doing heavy work. So I can't even imagine how our farm workers were feeling, because it was extremely hot. They were completely covered, many in hoodies, sweaters, you know, just face masks, hats, bandanas. You know, I'm sure they were feeling the heat much, much worse than me and everyone else out there.
You said in an interview with New York Magazine that you didn't see any water stations out there. You didn't see any AC or cool shaded areas. So here are people in such heat conditions, doing really hard work, wearing layers of clothing, and there's no water stations or any shaded areas?
No, unfortunately, there was no designated shaded areas for farm workers to take breaks at. The only shade was really provided by the cherry trees themselves. Other than that, there was not a whole lot for them. I didn't see any with coolers or anything. So they were very thankful once we approached them with water.
You also told them.
Go ahead. Food safety issues that when you're handling a crop like cherries or blueberries or something that's going to be served essentially fresh and raw, unprocessed, you know, relatively unprocessed to the public. So if the only place that you're able to seek shade is among the rows, then you, you know, there are growers that are interpreting that electrolyte beverages would not be allowed in there. And a lot of the employees, you know, so these shaded areas outside of the rows are crucial because while the worker safety rules may say, you know, you need to have shade or things like that, until we can clarify that, there's also USDA food handling rules. So it makes it, and I'll tell you, it's frustrating to me to see, how much emphasis is placed on the USDA food handling as opposed to, you know, the life and safety of the people that are working there.
Right. Elizabeth Strader is Director of Strategic Campaigns at the United Farm Workers, the nation's largest farm workers union. Chelsea Dimas is from a farm worker family and worked in the fields in eastern Washington as a child and a teenager. She still has family working in the fields and orchards. Chelsea's been doing volunteer outreach in the Yakima Valley during the recent extreme heat wave, and she's a candidate for a city council seat in Sunnyside, Washington. Today, we are talking about what it will take to protect farm workers, just to give them basic rights like water when it's so extremely hot or basic shade. If you have any questions for our guests, if you work on these issues, we'd love to hear from you. If you have questions about what you can do as someone who, you know, buys cherries, strawberries, blueberries, what can we all do to put pressure on to ensure that farm workers have basic protections? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org or tweet at your call radio. Chelsea, you also talk about how the workers go up and down ladders carrying large cherry bins. And you said that's actually why you stopped working. You fell off a ladder and broke your arm. You said you were hot, you passed out, and you fell. Can you just explain that process? How heavy are these bins, and what is it like to go up and down the ladder all day?
Well, I can definitely say that it's something I don't want to do again. You know, it's very hard work. It's very humbling work. And for me at the time, I think I was 12, 13 years old when this happened. And so I already wasn't, you know, I was still young and developing. So I wasn't very strong as I am now. And so carrying these bins that are basically almost my size, it's very hard to, I guess, in a sense, multitask because you're worrying about the weight of the bin, and it kind of moves around too. It doesn't really stay on one side. So as I'm adjusting myself, it's constantly like hitting my body. I'm slamming against the ladder. And I guess, you know, recapping that day, I just felt really hot and tired. And I remember just kind of looking up at the sun. And then I was on the floor and people were around me, including my family. And I was rushed to the hospital. That's essentially what I really remember. It was not a good feeling. I felt very tired, very lightheaded, and I ended up in the hospital. It all just happened extremely fast. And, you know, it's terrible that when I went out there, it felt like I was back into my old life. I felt like, you know, I was 12 or 13 years old again because nothing has changed. Everything felt exactly the same.
Wow. How often did you work in the fields at the age of 12 or 13?
I would say probably like 3-4 times a week. It just really depended. Honestly, we started working, you know, my family wasn't exactly, you know, we were living under the poverty line. So my mom had no choice but to take us to work. And eventually we just started working. It kind of just happened. And if we did have someone that could stay home with us, like usually a cousin or something, then we wouldn't go. But we were there pretty much, I would say, almost every day or almost every weekday.
Can we talk a little bit more about children working in the fields? Elizabeth Lorena, a 44-year-old agricultural worker near Sunnyside in Washington State, filmed several videos showing how blueberry pickers have had to adapt to the heat wave. And she told France 24 that because people started at 3 a.m., they had no choice but to bring their underage children with them because they didn't want to leave them home alone. And she said on one of the really hot days, a child almost fainted.
Yeah. So it's a nuanced conversation to talk about kids in the field. And it can be sometimes a painful conversation, even within our own communities, because, you know, so many of us grew up, you know, with families that made the choices that they had to make. In the state of Washington, there's actually kind of a complicated little set of algorithms where if you are 12 years old, there are certain crops that you are legally able to work in without restriction. In fact, if you're under 12, you can work in many of these as long as your relative owns the property, which is really not the case for the majority of folks that we're talking about in any realistic way. But so starting at 12, you know, kids can harvest. There's a lot of hand harvest crops that they are legally able to harvest, including blueberries. You have to be 14. Legally to work in tree fruit where there's going to be ladders and things like that. That unfortunately, I will say, is not necessarily reflected in reality. And then further, there are some guidelines around what hours. So we've had our you know, the workers are telling us that they've never seen, you know, in recent memory, they haven't seen as many kids in the fields as there are this year. And there's a couple of reasons for that are just, you know, pretty stark. But when you, even if you have been able to access childcare that you can reasonably afford, even just access to childcare at any price, this year, as we're coming out of this pandemic, the childcare shortage is significant. So even if you had an arrangement, whether it's with a cousin or, you know, with a sister-in-law or that sort of thing, if all of a sudden it's 117 degrees, so you have to start coming into work at 2 a.m. Well, there are no childcare centers open at 2 a.m. So people are making these decisions to bring, you know, do you leave your children that are 8, 9, 10, 11 years old? Do you leave them at home alone? Or do you bring them to work with you? So, you know, I don't think that there needs to be, what we need to have is a judgment of the system that makes this necessary. And that means, you know, I think that especially during cherry season, that the need for labor is so significant in central eastern Washington. It's a voracious appetite for labor. So they will hire anyone. And so, you know, we need to have a real stark conversation about the seasonality of some of these pinch points, especially as it starts to get hotter earlier in the season and longer and more extreme temperatures. We need to have a system for emergency childcare. We need to have a system for drop-in childcare. We need to think outside the box when it comes to some of the state funds that we could be using in Washington for things like setting up some short-term childcare that might be, you know, cohorts or things like that. And that is one thing that, you know, UFW has had a good amount of conversation with some of the growers associations about. There's just a systemic need for the childcare. There's a systemic need for the labor. And, you know, especially when you're talking about kids working at night, especially when you're talking about young people and elderly people using headlamps with ladders. And you know, in the Yakima Valley, that's rattlesnake country. I mean, working at night is dangerous in its own way. So there's some really, really tough decisions being made. And, you know, no one chooses to go into this line of work. It's dangerous. It shortens your lives. And no one chooses to bring their kids into the fields with them if they have any other options. The issue is there are no better options on the table right now.
You brought up important historical context for us, and we should say that agricultural workers on farms have been excluded from federal labor laws since 1935. So children as young as 12 can legally work as agricultural workers because of this?
It varies quite. And it varies from state to state. I think a lot of people, the average consumer, is pretty shocked when they. There's a couple of things that tends to really shock your average consumer when you talk about farm work. One of them is the fact that, you know, farm workers are excluded from some of these really basic protections, and that includes child labor. I think that's really shocking to people. The exact rules and laws and ages, they vary from state to state, and they've evolved over the years. But, you know, at the end of the day, agriculture is, one of the few industries that does have some of these really young children, you know, middle school age children that are perfectly, it's perfectly legal for a tobacco grower to hire children to harvest tobacco, even though tobacco and, you know, nicotine is neurotoxic. It's readily absorbed through the skin, and it's perfectly legal to hire children to harvest it. You just can't sell it to them until they're 21. So, you know, some of those, these things are really shocking to folks. Another thing that's really shocking is piece rate. And piece rates are, when you talk about piece rates, it's actually really, really deeply connected to the heat. Because a piece rate means instead of earning an hourly wage, the worker is paid, is compensated by the piece, by how much they harvest, which gives them a perverse incentive to push their bodies. And so, you know, no matter how hot it is, they're going to work as fast as they can, because otherwise, you know, a break, if they stop and take a break, that comes directly out of their own pocket. You know, they're not making an hourly wage. It's a piece rate. And when you think about these young children, whether it's a 14-year-old that's, you know, legally able to work in the cherries, if, you know, they're going up and down, they can't half fill that bin. They have to fill the bin all the way, because you can't go and take to get it tallied and weighed until it's full. So, you know, the piece rates shock people. By the way, in the Yakima Valley, the average piece rate for cherries during cherry season is 25 cents a pound.
You know, hold that thought.
We're going to take
a quick break, and then we'll talk more about piece rates after the break. And also, just to remind listeners, we did a show last month about a new documentary called Fruits of Labor. It features Ashley Solis, who has been working in California's strawberry fields since she was 15. She also worked overnight bagging frozen vegetables, going to high school at the same time, and she is now getting her master's degree. It really is an amazing film, and you can find that show at yourcallradio.org. That is Elizabeth Strader, Director of Strategic Campaigns at United Farm Workers. Chelsea DeMoss is from a farm worker family and worked in the fields in Eastern Washington as a child and teenager. Chelsea is a candidate for a city council seat in Sunnyside, Washington. On today's Your Call, we are talking about what it will take to protect farm workers. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the Supreme Court's recent decisions. There was a wide range of decisions. Coming up on today's show in just about 10 minutes, we'll talk about the decision that will make it harder for union organizers to meet farm workers at their place of work. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are talking about what it will take to protect farm workers, especially from the deadly heat. On Saturday, vigils were held for Sebastian Francisco Perez, a 38-year-old farm worker who tragically died on June 26th, the first day of the heat wave in St. Paul, Oregon, where temperatures topped 104 degrees. And you can read more about Sebastian at yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Elizabeth Strader, Director of Strategic Campaigns with United Farm Workers. Chelsea DeMoss is from a farm worker family. Chelsea worked in the fields in Eastern Washington as a child and a teenager. She's a candidate for a city council seat in Sunnyside, Washington. Chelsea, can you also talk about the piece rate and how this makes it so difficult for farm workers to take any time off?
Yeah, I think any of the legalities or like the logistics of it, that'll probably be a better question for Elizabeth, but I can definitely talk about it from a, I guess, my personal experience. I guess as far as I remember, my parents never took a day off. They were constantly working regardless of what the weather looked like. They never took a day off. They were constantly gone if not, we weren't there at work with them. And it's the same thing that I saw that I'm seeing now and, you know, that I've heard from some of my friends and their families that are out there working. You know, they have to plan in advance, like way in advance, if they're able to take any time off, if they're able to, you know, make up those hours and figure that out. And right now, I know with the heat wave, a lot of farm workers were adjusting their hours and working, you know, these crazy, you know, graveyard hours, you know, starting at 11 p.m. some or 2 a.m. just so they can get in and, you know, and get out before the heat wave got even worse. But not everyone was able to do that. So we still saw a significant amount of farm workers out there until I would say around noon is probably the last farm worker I saw leave. And so it's very difficult to try to balance that. You know, if they're sick, if they're, you know, want a day off for just a special occasion or just to rest, it's just not possible, really. And, you know, having these protections would be nice for them because it is hard work. And I can't stress that enough.
Before we let you go, let's also talk about this federal bill. It's called the Asunción Valdivia Heat Illness and Fatality Prevention Act. It's in honor of a California farm worker who died in 2004 after picking grapes for 10 hours straight in temperatures that rose to 105 degrees. This bill was introduced in the House and the Senate this year, and according to ABC, it aims to require OSHA to establish an enforceable standard of protections like access to water, paid breaks in cool areas, limits on time in the heat, providing emergency responses. So what are your thoughts about this federal bill? Because it seems like rather than hoping that these bills pass at the state level, there needs to be one bill so you don't have to do all of this work in every state that has an agricultural sector.
That's exactly the case. So in California, we work real hard to get some standards set in California. This federal bill is modeled on the same set of really minimal standards. And these are standards required not for long-term health and longevity. These are standards for what it takes to get up and not die at work today. So these aren't cushy. You know, we base these standards on the bare minimum that the U.S. military determined was required to keep soldiers alive in extreme circumstances. So we're really not talking about really cushy things. It's water, preventative breaks, and those breaks need to be in the shade, out of the sun. So even in California, where we have these rules in place, there's always going to be, you know, compliance issues in any industry for outdoor workers. But in California, we have a standard. But for example, if you're in the Coachella Valley, there's parts of, you know, there's a lot of these workers are migrant. They may be housed in Arizona and be working part of the time in Arizona and part of the time in California. Arizona does not have a standard. A Salinas farm worker is going to go and be working in San Luis, Arizona, or, you know, as these folks move around, it is so difficult not only to fight these battles state by state by state by state. It's really difficult to educate the workers as to what their rights are. So we really desperately need a federal heat standard. If we have a federal standard, even the workers in California will be safer because there will be one set of rules that we can look to. So there is this bill set. It has been introduced both in the House and a companion bill in the Senate. We are really looking to folks at the national, at the federal level for their leadership, because we should not be in this position where state after state we're looking for emergency rules. Some hope of emergency rules in Washington and Oregon in the next little bit, and then what? That still leaves us 47 more states. So we really do need this federal standard.
What will it take? What are you hearing from people on Capitol Hill?
at the state level, I think there is always, unfortunately, a grim moment where there is a death to point to, and hoping that a public cycle of grief is going to cause action. So in Oregon, for example, we had they had emergency, they had rules drafted. They had rules drafted, but they weren't going to be put in place until September. And in the meantime, workers die. And that's pretty searing, you know. It was just a purely administrative delay. And, we needed emergency action to meet an emergency situation. We are still in the position in Washington where, we have the UFW has formally petitioned for emergency rulemaking and for permanent rules as well. Both of those petitions have been accepted, but at this moment, there's still no rule on the books.
Chelsea, before we let you go, we're getting some messages from listeners saying, what can we do about this?
Honestly, the biggest thing anyone can do is learn about these issues. You know, it just takes a simple Google search or just visiting local farms, you know, obviously without trespassing. I'm not going to encourage anyone to do that, but, you know, to just check on them and see these harsh realities that they face, you know, on the daily, you know, learning about them, donating to organizations like UFW, you know, just doing these things, spreading it on social media, you know, a simple share, comment, you know, you can do all of these things and they take, you know, just a few minutes of your time. And also, you know, talking to your friends and family. If you have, you know, family that are in a position of privilege, maybe they can donate and do something about it. You know, talk to your community, you know, ask questions, you know, just don't be afraid to just put yourself out there. And, you know, like, it took me just one day volunteering and, you know, honestly, us as a community, there's so much power when we are united. And so I feel like us together as a collective, we can do anything. And so I'm really thankful that I'm doing something that's much bigger than myself. And I just hope that with these interviews, with my platform, with my campaign, that I can inspire other people to do the same. And that's really it for me, you know?
Well, Chelsea, thank you for your advocacy. And thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much. And again, I appreciate all of the work you're doing to spotlight these issues. And thank you, Elizabeth, as well. So keep in touch.
We definitely will. Thank you. That is Chelsea DeMoss. Chelsea is from a farm worker family and worked in the fields in Eastern Washington as a child and a teenager. She still has family working in the fields and orchards, and she is a candidate for a city council seat in Sunnyside, Washington. And sticking with us for the rest of the hour is Elizabeth Strader, Director of Strategic Campaigns at United Farm Workers. I would also like to welcome Kate Cimini, a reporter with the Salinas Californian and CalMatters California Divide Project. Kate covers economic inequality, agriculture, and housing. Her latest piece for CalMatters is called Supreme Court Favors Property Rights Over Farm Workers Unions. And you can find a link at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Kate. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's great to have you on. Can you give us a little bit of background on this case, Cedar Point Nursery versus, is it Hasid?
Yes, I believe that's how it's pronounced, although I'm not an expert.
Okay. Well, can you tell us a little bit about, give us some background on this case?
So basically what happened is a couple of union organizers attempted to access Cedar Point Nurseries and Fowler Packing Company out in Fresno, in order to speak with workers, and were prevented from doing so, I understand, by management at the farm. And then Cedar Point Nurseries and Fowler joined forces and filed with the courts in California, basically saying that they felt that this this was an inappropriate taking, I think, was the phrase that they used of their property. And it was rejected by the courts in California, but made its way to the Supreme Court. where the court, you know, falling along a 6-3 ideological split, Republican versus Democrat, held that indeed they considered this a inappropriate taking of the property without payment. And so currently union organizers in California are not allowed to access farm property to speak with farm workers.
Elizabeth, can you give us a little bit of context here? Before this case was filed, tell us about what the UFW does when it wants to speak directly with farm workers.
Well, there's a number of you know, there's a number of ways that we keep connected with the farm worker community. It was quite a narrow scope of access under the rule that California had, you know, under the law that California had put into place that did provide under, you know, really specific terms, including advance notice and, you know, specific times and a certain number of hours, a certain number of days a year. So, you know, that was never sort of a go-to default. That was never our entire toolbox, right? It's just one tool. So knowing the makeup of the court and seeing that this case was going to be heard, I don't think anyone was surprised by the outcome. That being said, if you look back at the last several years, you know, we had maybe used that access a few times a year. In 2020, that number went up quite a bit, and that number really was as much as anything responding to the pandemic and then extreme heat and then toxic air quality and fire displacement that you have with these workers. So part of the reason that it was there in the first place is just the smallest effort at a really unlevel playing field, because when you're talking about some of these workers, we're talking about folks that are living on site. Their housing is controlled by their employer. Their transportation to and from work site is controlled by the employer. These are workers that are working in extreme both social and geographic isolation. So it's not like a steel mill or even like a nursing home where you wait until the shift change. You know, you can talk to folks at home, you can do house visits, you can meet them offsite. These are folks that are, you know, the overwhelming majority of their time is spent within private property controlled entirely by their employer. So that was California's attempt to, you know, create some special standards. And that's what was so interesting about the outcome is, you know, it was that ideological split. And you look, and there's a certain irony at these justices that are, you know, in theory, conservatives that have gone to such lengths to protect a state's ability to set their own rules and to write their own laws. And in this case, they, you know, California tried to level that playing field, and these conservative justices determined that, you know, that the Supreme Court could overturn the state's rights to choose to protect these workers.
Kate, you spoke with a number of people about this ruling. How will this affect workers who are in dire need of protections, basic protections?
So funny you say that, because Elizabeth is one of those people I spoke with.
Right.
So, you know, she gave a pretty, I think, succinct example. In general, I think a lot of people who were concerned that this would harm workers were really concerned about the growing number of indigenous farm workers in California who, you know, speak neither English nor Spanish, you know, may not read English or Spanish. A lot of indigenous languages are, you know, they're not written, they're spoken. And so this would prevent them from effectively organizing or knowing their rights if, you know, if they don't frequently leave the property, if, you know, they are housed on the property where they work.
What explains the rise of indigenous workers in the fields in California?
You know what? That's a great question, and it's not one that I'm prepared to answer at the moment.
Elizabeth, do you know?
I think that we're all having a lot of conversations at the existential level about, you know, the driving factors being in their what we call the sending communities, their home communities, that are having folks make the choices to, you know, come and do this work that is so dangerous, that is so grueling, that is so low paid. And, you know, that's a much bigger question, you know, outside of the ag industry as well. It's a bigger question. So, but, you know, regardless of whether it is because they speak a minority indigenous language, whether they have varying levels of literacy in any language, you know, it is not as simple as a Facebook group. It is not as simple as cell phones. There are a lot of folks that do not have access to reliable cell phone, reliable internet, and simply just don't have the tools to use that as a method. So,
Kate, you write that not all California farmers are impacted by the decision. John Darijo, CEO of Darijo Brothers in Salinas, said the Supreme Court decision would not change the way he works with the UFW. The company sells produce under the brand Andy Boy. He says his workers have been unionized through the UFW for about 40 years. The contracts explicitly allow union reps access to the property and the farm workers. So this raises the question, you know, for those of us who want to support, you know, farmers who treat their farm workers with basic respect and who run a union farm, what is the best way to find that information? I've never heard of the Andy Boy products.
So DiRigo Brothers does sell produce under the name Andy Boy. Andy Boy has the patent on, for example, Broccoli Rob. It's entirely possible that you haven't heard of Andy Boy, but you have eaten the food. You know, I am honestly not sure how I'd go about if I wanted to specifically support, farmers who have unionized farm workers. I'm not sure how I'd go about finding that out. I personally learned about that through a lot of research and word of mouth that led to that research and then contacting DiRigo Brothers to find out.
Can you tell us just
so
based
on
your...
So if you wanted to find UFW union contract employers, produce brands, things like that, especially wine, you can look on our website at ufw.org/UL. UL as in union label. So it's ufw.org/UL.
Yeah, because I'm thinking, you know, going to the grocery store, if you're lucky enough to have a store that sells all of this gorgeous produce, you might look at the label, but you have no idea really where it comes from. I guess you could, when you go to a farmer's market, talk to the person selling the produce and ask about how farm workers are treated. Would that be one thing you could do, Elizabeth?
Yeah, for sure. And if you once you look at these sort of union labels, now that you've heard the name, Andy Boy, it's interesting. You will see, as you look at these things, you'll realize when you go to the grocery store, you may not have thought about the branding and the packaging around these products, but you'll start to recognize them in the grocery store.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I was also wondering, Kate, given all the reporting you've done on this, for example, John Darijo, why is he working with the UFW and then some of these other farms are not? Have you been able to ask the farmers who are not working with the union why they're not?
again, a great question. I know that the DiRigo Brothers, they have organized labor because this dates back to the 1970s in Salinas, where there was a lot of labor strikes. Things got really tough. The UFW was definitely involved in that. Cesar Chavez and DiRigo Brothers is one of the few companies in the Salinas Valley that is organized through the UFW. Speaking with farmers who, don't have organized workforces, in general, they've been very glad they don't have organized workforces, for typical reasons that you would hear from people who don't, want that involved. They, feel that it creates a barrier between them and the workers, that they are held to unfair standards, that, they could be faced with work actions and they really, they don't want to interrupt the flow of their work.
Elizabeth, we're almost out of time, but we have a question from a listener who says, I buy organic produce at farmers markets. Can I expect that farm workers are treated better?
Well, you don't necessarily, that's going to be that's a tough question. I wouldn't say that the worker standard across the line is going to be markedly better. You can have a pesticide-free yet entirely toxic workplace, but the pesticide exposure is really a the pesticides haunt farm workers. They really do. You think about the folks that you'll see they put a towel on there. If there's someone who drives themselves to and from work, they'll put a towel on their car. They wash their clothes separately from their children's clothes. Pesticide exposure is real. It absolutely shortens workers' lives. For example, the UFW contracts banned DDT far before the EPA did. So, I'm not saying that every organic employer is a great employer, but, pesticides are something that really shortens farm workers' lives.
Right. And so basically, if you really care about these issues, check the union section on the UFW website. And then if you go to a farmer's market, really ask how the farm workers are treated and hope that they're honest with their answers. Right, Elizabeth?
Absolutely. Okay. It really is. I mean, there's a million reasons why employers don't want to have UFW on their property. If they have union workers, workers are going to get paid more. They're going to get more breaks. They're going to get vacation time. They're going to have retirement plans, medical plans. They don't want us. I understand. I don't agree, but I understand. But if you're looking at a company, an employer like Dorigo that has had the Andy Boy label, that has had this relationship of trust with their workers for, at this point we've had a union contract for 40 years. We work very well. It has not ended their ability to be a viable and productive company. So, I think that you're also going to find that when it's a union job that has benefits and paid time off and things like that, they're going to have less trouble securing the workforce that they need to get the crops out of the field.
Elizabeth Strader is Director of Strategic Campaigns at United Farm Workers. Kate Samini is a reporter with the Salinas Californian and CalMatters California Divide Project. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your